Welcome to another exciting edition of Shedding Lights. And today, a returning guest, Mr. George Cattermole, a local activist, a former Stanford lecturer, and Vietnam War protester back in the day right here on the campus. And George, you're back with us today, and the subject today is going to be torture, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Good. But you like to start out every segment that you do on this particular show, Shedding Light, with a poem by Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty. And he's why don't you just kind of introduce Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty as you know him. What is he? He owned City Lights Bookstore. He almost went to jail for life over putting out Howl, the book by Allen Ginsberg. How else would you describe him?
There's actually a movie about that now, I think.
Might be. Probably a documentary. He's been all over everything. How would you describe Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty?
Well, he's
an icon.
He's a person to listen to. And he has a little book called Poetry as Insurgent Art, which is, for me, a kind of Bible. He comes to the store, likes the music at the store, and he asked me, he has a poem that he wrote about a year ago, I guess, maybe a little longer than that. I think he redid it. I think he's been reworking it, called Pity the Nation, and he asked me to get that out. He asked Amy Goodman to get that out, too. She played it on one of her shows. But it pretty much, I think, talks about the state of affairs today in this country. So, yeah, let's hear it.
Yeah, lots. And then we're going to bring on Scott Horton, a world-renowned authority on the subject of torture.
Pity the nation whose people are sheep and whose shepherds mislead them. Pity the nation whose leaders are liars, whose sages are silenced, and whose bigots haunt the airwaves. Pity the nation that raises not its voice except to praise conquerors and acclaim the bully as hero and aims to rule the world with force and by torture. Pity the nation that knows no other language but its own and no other culture but its own. Pity the nation whose breath is money and sleeps the sleep of the too well fed. Pity the nation. Oh, pity the people who will allow their rights to erode and their freedoms to be washed away. My country, tears of thee, sweet land of liberty.
And that was Lawrence Ferlinghetti here on Shedding Lights. We have George Cattermole in the studio, and I do believe we have Scott Horton on the phone. Scott, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Great to have you. Thank you for your time. And Scott, my name is Bird, and I'm the host of Shedding Light here at KZSU. We've never spoken because George is bringing you in as a guest. And would you briefly introduce yourself, Scott?
I am a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, I've been involved in writing about the torture issue pretty much from before the Abu Ghraib days. I'm also an attorney, a former chair of the International Law Committee at the New York City Bar Association, and I'm a law lecturer at Columbia Law School in New York City.
And once again, welcome to KZSU. And George, why don't you go ahead and tell us why you contacted Scott for today.
Well, the last few times I've been on this show, we've been talking about Mr. Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice just right across the street here at the Hoover Institute. I think I mentioned last time, there's something very wrong with what's going on right now. There were a few rotten apples that were responsible for our torturing, but the first rotten apple I would name would be Bush, and the second one would be Cheney. And I found out that there was going to be a conference having to do with torture. QUIT, the Quaker Initiative to End Torture, I believe it's their fourth conference that they had, and they had it here locally, Ben Lomond. And Scott Horton was a speaker there, so I looked up his work. I wasn't acquainted with it, but he's been following this issue for a long time. And Scott, I want to thank you for doing this program today. And I was going to ask you, I was not able to go to the conference, but I wondered if you perhaps could tell our listeners what occurred there.
Well, we had a number of guest speakers, and a number of different issues that were examined. So, I've written mostly about torture as an international law issue, and torture as a practice introduced by the Bush administration in the War on Terror. But we also discussed torture as it occurs in American prisons, and in fact, right now, in fact, the U.S. Department of Justice acknowledges it has a horrible problem with torture being practiced in federal prisons and in state prisons around the country. There have been a number of federal court determinations to that effect. Rape is one recurrent problem all over the country. And in fact, the Justice Department has agreed by consent decree to set up a program to try and redress it. Then we talked about the School of Americas, based at Fort Benning, Georgia, and its practice of training people from Latin America and training counterterrorism techniques. So its work has been linked for many, many years, in fact, conclusively, to the introduction of torture practices, as well as the overthrow of democratically elected governments in Latin America. That started as sort of a left-wing fringe criticism, and then, lo and behold, 1996 documents came out establishing quite conclusively that that left-wing fringe criticism was absolutely correct. And the Los Angeles Times, San Francisco Chronicle, New York Times were all high up the list of papers calling for the school to be closed. But here we are, 14 years later, and it's still open and thriving with a different name right now. Finally, we talked about the Obama administration, its pledge to end torture and to change a number of Bush-era policies in the War on Terror, and its failure to come through on most of those promises, including closing down Guantanamo.
Yeah, in fact, my understanding is that this recent ruling by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, I think it was 6-5, that was a close call, I guess, but some of the lawyers who were arguing that they wanted to look into these matters, we were sort of surprised that Obama's attorneys were arguing the way they did. State secrets, I guess, was invoked to protect people like Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld and Wu. Am I right about that?
Not just the lawyers were surprised. The judges were surprised because this was, you're talking about the en banc decision, which was just handed down.
Yes,
but
yes.
Previously, at the end of last year, there was an argument in the panel before a three-judge panel, and all three judges, when the Justice Department came in and made its arguments, they said, no, wait a minute, stop here. This is diametrically, what you're saying is the government's position is diametrically opposed to what Barack Obama stated would be the position of his administration during the campaign. And so before we go forward with any arguments, we want you to go back to the Justice Department and confirm that what you're telling us is the government's position really is the government's position. And so they were basically incredulous that this was happening. And indeed, the Department of Justice came back and said, no change, exactly the same position as under the Bush administration, exactly the same arguments, no change whatsoever. And the Ninth Circuit split right down the middle, 6-5. In fact, it was on a straight party line vote between Democratically and Republican Republican appointees and Democratic appointees, because we have an edge for the Republicans right now in this court. On this question, and I think, you know, there's a fascinating background or backdrop to this decision, which is this has to do with the Extraordinary Renditions Program, and it has to do with a whole series of different rendition cases, and the rendition cases that are covered here include, of course, the Abu Omar case and the Khalid al-Masri case, which are currently the subject of criminal investigations in Europe right now. In fact, 23 American officials have been indicted and convicted of assault and kidnapping by an Italian court, and we have 13 more who are subject to arrest warrants by the Spanish court and others who are targets of the investigation in Germany. And what's really going on here is very, very simple. The Justice Department is acting as a criminal defense law firm for American officials. And it is concerned that these litigations, if they go forward, will inevitably wind up in exposing facts and information which will further these pending prosecutions in Europe and will jeopardize American elected officials. So we have the Justice Department not acting to enforce the law, but rather acting to subvert the justice process, acting as criminal defense lawyers for officials of the prior administration. And I'll just give you one specific example here. Condoleezza Rice, of course, former provost at Stanford, was national security advisor in the first Bush term and was Secretary of State in the second term. And the prosecutor in Milan has stated he's attempting to identify who specifically authorized the kidnapping and abduction of Mullah Omar from Milan. And all evidence points to Condoleezza Rice as the person who authorized. So she is clearly the subject of a pending criminal investigation in Italy.
And as I understand it, too, there were at least Obama's come through by issuing a pretty much a clear ban on torture. But he also had promised and has talked about how he's shut down the CIA black sites. But it's my understanding that there's some speculation now that there's another part of the government, the Joint Special Operations Command, whatever the heck that is now doing the same thing, this extraordinary rendition. Again, this reminds me of enhanced interrogation techniques. What we're talking about is shipping people off to be tortured somewhere else. Am I right?
Yeah, we're far beyond speculation on this point. In fact, something curious that happened is that executive order that was issued by Barack Obama on the second day of his administration, as originally drafted and circulated, it shut down black sites, these overseas detention operations not connected to criminal justice administration. And as it was finally signed, it was slightly modified so that it shut down black sites operated by the CIA. And a lot of people looked at it and thought, like, where did that come from? Why was it necessary to insert that limitation in it? Of course, now we know that in the first 2 days, Obama was briefed about the existence of a second independent black site operation run by JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, which is under the Pentagon. And, you know, subsequently, New York Times and Washington Post and others have disclosed specific information about the location of these black sites, particularly the most important one, which is a so-called black jail run on the periphery of the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. But we know of at least five other black sites operated by JSOC. We still don't know a lot of detail about who's passed through them and what the conditions are, but the information coming out of Afghanistan about the black jail suggests that this is the most abusive treatment of prisoners that occurred anywhere, including Abu Ghraib.
Just for our people listening, you're listening now to Scott Horton, an attorney who also he writes for Harper's Magazine, and I recommend very highly to people that you go you can go take a look at his columns there. He's also author of the No Comment blog on Harper's Online, and there's an excellent piece I enjoyed very much reading, your piece on Condi's really bad day when she came back here to Stanford. I've been around here for quite a while, taught here for many years, but I remember hearing her say something about she was looking forward to coming back to the life of the mind. Well, she did come back to the life of the mind, because when she was first arrived, I think it was in Robley Hall, a student asked her some rather good questions about her relationship to torture, and I think you did an excellent job sort of pointing out that the student was right on point and that her answers were really pretty pathetic. I think Mr.
Look, consistently wrong. I mean, there were six separate points where she gave an answer where her answer was factually incorrect.
Yeah.
And the students called her on it. I mean, in fact, they were able immediately to spot the deception, evasion, or falsehood and point it out. And she was completely nonplussed by this. And what I point out is that this is the difference between places like the campus of Stanford University and the White House Press Corps in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. The White House Press Corps adopts this absolutely fawning attitude towards administration officials. Whether they're Democrat or Republican doesn't matter. They will never cross them, they will never question them, and they will never hit them with a tough or difficult question. And, you know, she was expecting what she had been exposed to in Washington, but what she got in Stanford was a bunch of really smart kids who don't put up with BS.
Yeah, and in fact, I think one of the, as I recall, one of her statements was that torture is what my president tells me it is. Something like that. I mean, it was unbelievable, really.
This was on the question of whether torture was unlawful, and mm-hmm. and she said, if the president authorizes it, it's not unlawful. And of course, that almost perfectly parallels what Richard Nixon said at the peak of Watergate. That means mm-hmm. if the president does it, it's not illegal. Which, it reflects his recognition that he was in deep doo-doo, as one of his successors said. Yeah. Certainly isn't the statement of the law. But the Condoleezza Rice would say that was really amazing.
Yeah, I think she also didn't use the word torture. She talked about enhanced interrogation techniques. And I've spoken before on this program. Hannah Arendt, in her book Eichmann in Jerusalem, points out that the Nazis did the same thing with language, where you basically obfuscate and use words that to sort of steer people away from the reality of it all. And in fact, I had a little discussion with Professor Zimbardo here, and you have an excellent column on him when he testified in a trial of one of the bad apples that tortured, pointing out that this couldn't have happened if it weren't for a policy, and if it weren't for people upstairs really sort of winking and nodding and letting it go on.
That's right, and of course the military was extremely upset that Zimbardo was testifying at those proceedings. They put the military defense team that were handling the case under a lot of pressure not to call him. Why? Because he disclosed one of the obvious fallacies in the defense that Donald Rumsfeld put up, the bad apples defense. One of the things that had happened is that the U.S. had a long tradition of very clear regulation of prisoners in wartime with clear rules and protocols that were followed. And Donald Rumsfeld took those rules away. And anybody who is familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment knows that what would happen if the rules were taken away was completely predictable, which was torture and abuse. That was the upshot of that experiment, which is universally accepted now among psychologists as well as amongst prison authorities.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that I learned from your writings going over them was that this has been played out a couple hundred years ago in England, where the battle was fought a long time ago about secret trials and what have you. And I thought when I was reading it that you have Scalia and all these people talking about original intent. Well, it was almost as if we don't need to talk about this. This has been solved. Am I right about that?
Absolutely correct. It's one of the areas where Scalia is consistently demonstrating he claims to be an originalist, but he consistently demonstrates that he really doesn't understand much about the constitutional history of the country. But in any event, this is the pre-constitutional history. So what's the immediate background to our revolution? And the immediate legal background really focuses on the time of the English Civil War. It's the 1640s, 1650s. And all the issues that were coming up and being litigated in connection with the War on Terror, all issues that came up and were disputed vociferously during the time of the English Civil War and the two decades before it. So that included the use of habeas corpus, conducting trials with secret evidence, closing the trials, and the use of torture. All those things were common practices. And the revolution, the Civil War in England, was really waged in large part against those practices, which were openly labeled as tyrannical practices. And of course, the people who led that charge against them were our Puritan fathers. In fact, New England, particularly the Massachusetts Bay Colony, was the absolute center ground of the rabble-rousers during the Civil War. Almost the entire first graduating class of Harvard University went to fight against the king in the Civil War. So there's no question about our background and our pre-constitutional history and the fact that rejection of torture, the acceptance of the notion of habeas corpus, these clear standards for open and public trials were all understood by the founding fathers as a check against tyrannical and abusive power exercised by the king. And now we see the American executive attempting to assert the same powers that our forefathers denied the English monarchs.
Right. Yeah. I just want to tell people out there, you're listening to Scott Horton. He's an attorney from New York. His work is in human rights laws and the law of armed conflict. He writes for Harper's Magazine, and he's also the author of the No Comment blog at Harper's Online. I find it interesting that, going back to Rumsfeld and Rice and these people, that when they were beating the drums for war, we heard about the mushroom cloud, but we also heard that there was a connection between Al-Qaeda and 9/11. And I think what I understand now is that there was a real push by the government to get somebody to confess to this connection, and sure enough, torture produced the confession.
You mean between 9/11 and Iraq, I think, right?
Between that Saddam Hussein was connected to Al-Qaeda.
So
what happened was, I mean, the war, of course, caused terror, caused torture, but in a way it was torture that caused the war, because it was one of the reasons that we went, because we were told that Al-Qaeda and Saddam were together, which I don't think occurred until after we attacked, right?
Well, that's right. The case for that point becomes clearer and clearer every single week. So last week we had the disclosure of further documents from the U.S. archives, which included notes from National Security Council meetings, in which you can see Mr. Rumsfeld scribbling down right after 9/11, in fact 9/12, how do we make the case for invading Iraq? Have to find a link, underscored several times. It's completely clear. And in fact, previously we had Richard Clark saying this. He was attending these meetings, and he says that Rumsfeld said during these meetings that Afghanistan was not a target-rich environment, that they needed to go to war against Iraq, and they would have to make this case. So clearly there was just immense pressure brought to bear to fabricate a case to the effect that Saddam Hussein was behind the 9/11 incident, and to do that they wanted to link him to Al-Qaeda. And in fact, U.S. intelligence at this time was saying, not so. These Salafi extremists are the enemy of Saddam's regime. He's arresting them, and he's torturing and abusing them. He has nothing to do with them. These claims are really bogus. And when those reports came, the instructions that came out of the White House were, find something. A real strong push. And that led to fabrication of evidence and torture. So, in fact, Colin Powell is the strongest witness for this claim right now. Because Colin Powell states he went to the Security Council of the United Nations to make the case for the United States for the invasion of Iraq, and he did so based on information that came from a witness named Al-Libi. And subsequently, we've learned that Al-Libi was tortured, and the evidence that he gave that was used by Colin Powell before the Security Council was completely untrue. And it was evidence, it was information that was given because he knew his interrogator wanted him to say these things, and to get the torture to stop, he had to say them. So, the falsehoods, the lies that were literally used to take the country to war against Iraq were induced by torture.
I wonder, I've heard that there's a Professor Boyle at the University of Illinois who a while back filed a complaint naming Bush and Cheney, Rumsfeld, Tenet, Rice, Gonzalez. But now with this recent ruling, do you think there's any way that one branch or the other, the government can hold these people accountable?
Well, I think what we see in the series of rulings basically are Republican appointee federal judges, and it really is a remarkable division between those who are appointed by Democrats and those who are appointed by Republicans. Republican appointees render any ruling necessary to block accountability on the part of Republican officials of the executive. So they have strained notions of immunity, executive immunity, way past the breaking point, using the Westfall Act and all sorts of other doctrines. And these notions of immunity run directly contrary to American tradition. American tradition, as articulated by James Madison in 1793, for instance, was that a criminal act is never protected by the doctrine of immunity. Madison stated that. And so have other presidents made such statements. And then under international law, you know, the U.S. put forward the notion in 1946 at the Nuremberg trial that notions of immunity of state actors cannot be invoked to block prosecutions for crimes against humanity. Waging wars of aggression, of course, are crimes against humanity, but much more specifically, specific acts of torture and abuse of detainees are crimes against humanity, which may not be immunized. That's a fundamental principle of international law articulated by the United States in 1946 and accepted by the United States in convention. So what we're seeing in these court cases are Republican judges directly defying treaty commitments and obligations of the United States under international law and defying American law on these points, all heightening the powers of the executive. And where will this lead? Hard to say. But one consequence of this is that under notions of universal jurisdiction, when American courts decline to exercise jurisdiction, foreign courts are entitled to exercise this jurisdiction. And as I mentioned before, we have criminal prosecutions going on in Italy now. We have a criminal investigation pending in Germany, actually, two of them. Yeah. Another one in Poland. And Prime Minister Cameron, just after being coming to office in Britain, one of his first official duties was to call Barack Obama and tell him that, you know, I'm sorry, we know your view is don't look forward, don't look back. However, I am legally obligated to open a criminal investigation into what happened in Binyam Mohammed's case. That is one of the cases that was decided adversely by the Ninth Circuit, where they kept the door closed. He's directed to do that by the British Court of Appeal, which, in fact, ruled exactly the opposite of the Ninth Circuit, saying that it was fundamentally unlawful and wrong for the executive ever to invoke state secrets to block the probing of a crime. And they said, this is a crime. So they dealing with the exact same case the Ninth Circuit was dealing with, the Court of Appeal in Britain, which is generally considered to be an extremely conservative court, came to the exact opposite conclusion, unanimously.
Right. Well, I wonder, just very quickly, because thank you for all this time that you've given us, but I'm just curious, you know, we have a law school here at Stanford. We have a political science department, and Condoleezza Rice is a professor there. And I talk to students, and, you know, what can anybody do? You've got a lot of law students here. Is there something they could be working on? Is there something that I'm hoping that Condi will give a course in torture in the political science department, but I think she's probably being pretty careful about that now. But do you have any recommendations as to what students can do to address this?
Well, I think what happened on her first day on campus is a good example of exactly what should happen. That is, people should confront and engage her, and they should do it in a polite, scholarly way. It's the tradition of the university that we have animated conversation. But I think one thing that comes out of these discussions every time they occur is that Condoleezza Rice consistently uses false statements to cover up her record here. And I think these falsehoods are easily caught and disclosed. And I think, frankly, as more documents come out, which will happen, even though the government's trying to keep the lid on everything with state secrets, it won't work. Everything does eventually come out, and it'll come out largely because of the criminal investigations going on overseas. It'll be easier to show where she's misleading people. And I think one of the things we should be doing is pushing people like Condi and Don Rumsfeld to acknowledge when they made mistakes.
Right.
And we've heard none of that so far.
Great. Well, listen, thank you so much. That was Scott Horton. And thanks a lot for your views. And very much admire your work. And I suggest to everybody out there that you go to Harper's Magazine, go to the No Comment blog on Harper's Online, and keep current with this issue. It's a very important issue. Thanks again, Scott.
Great to be with you. Take care.
Thanks.